This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
You know, I think it'd be interesting just to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient ends, and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. 8 years into Al Franken's service as a U.S. senator, it's getting a little hard to remember the original. That Al Franken was a comedy writer, one of the founding writers on Saturday Night Live, and he put on really tight pants one night and gyrated obscenely in a killer imitation of Mick Jagger. You might want to go to YouTube and watch the whole thing. You know, and it's also pretty hard to remember that the senator from Minnesota was also the guy who did Stuart Smalley's Daily Affirmations.
Okay, today I've decided to talk about something I really know nothing about, politics. Basically, I'm very apolitical. I guess the only politicians I've really ever admired are Martin Luther King, although a woman in my Al-Anon group said he was a compulsive sex addict, and Mahatma Gandhi, who a woman in my Overeaters Anonymous group said had an eating disorder. But that's okay. No one is perfect.
Al Franken took a turn toward politics with books like Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot. But he eventually gave up the books and the sketches to make a serious run for office and to become a serious senator. Now he's returned to form. He's got a new book out called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. The cover shows him as a parody version of a distinguished senator in a sober suit with a fireplace roaring behind him and his hand resting gently on a globe. It's a good joke, but Franken has, in fact, become genuinely senatorial over the years. In the confirmation hearings for Attorney General Jeff Sessions, it was Franken who asked an extremely pointed question about Russian contacts with the Trump campaign. Sessions gave an evasive answer that caused a ripple effect leading to his recusal and eventually to the hiring of Robert Mueller as special investigator. I spoke to Al Franken last week. The other night, John McCain gave a remarkable speech, and he said many things, and one of them was that the Senate, as an institution, is not overburdened by greatness. And when you go into the Senate every day, are you filled with a feeling of awe, or, as he was expressing, a kind of not just disappointment, but almost a revulsion about what's happened to the deliberative body?
I get all of those, everyone. You know, I have a number of my colleagues who I am in awe of. I have...
Who are they?
Sheldon Whitehouse, just on policy after policy, but especially on things like climate change and campaign finance reform. I just, he's been such a leader. I'm in awe of Dick Durbin. Dick Durbin, he can, better than anyone I know, just talk extemporaneously. I thought it was an awesome move by Chuck Schumer when John McCain, who I'm in awe of, put his thumb down, and there was some applause, I think, from staff. And Chuck turned and went, no.
That there shouldn't be applause.
Absolutely.
Why is that? That's not the decorum of the floor?
Yeah, and we shouldn't, no gloating. It was a big victory because it meant that we're going to have to, that we get to work in a bipartisan way to address what in the ACA isn't working as well as it should.
So my understanding was that the Republicans knew that John McCain was going to vote against what the so-called skinny health care bill, but the Democratic side did not. You didn't know that this vote was coming?
I did not know this for sure. I didn't know it. And I started at a certain point, because of body language, see, I have what's called emotional IQ.
What was the body language?
The body language was Pence talking to Murkowski and getting nowhere, and her jaw being set, and then Pence walking out of the room.
Right there on the floor during
the
deliberations.
And if they had the votes, he would have sat in the chair, like he did, the previous day when they got the 50 to for him to cast a tie-breaking vote.
Apparently Hillary Clinton's new book is going to be called What Happened?
Yeah, I actually think it should be What Happened? I mean, in other words, there should be a question mark.
Can you answer that question, though? I mean, let's go back again. We know the litany.
I can tell you what happened.
Go ahead.
Okay. She and her campaign assumed they're going to win because he had so, in their eyes, disqualified himself as someone America would trust with the presidency. And it was a whole bunch of things. But, of course, the Access Hollywood thing, I think, was the point at which they went, okay.
Game, set, match.
Yeah, yeah. And then what happened then was I think they failed to continue to reach out with an economic message to those people who feel really angry in this country because for 40 years, the way I grew up wasn't happening. It wasn't happening that you would, you know, you kind of felt it was your birthright as an American that your kids would do better than you. And that hasn't been happening. And they're mad about that. And they're seeing very often their communities being hollowed out.
This is legitimate.
Oh, God, yes. Absolutely. And I think she just stopped aggressively reaching out to those people and explaining our, not only our philosophy, but policies to make it possible for their kids to have a better life, to have a secure middle-class life. And somehow Donald Trump got to attack her as a member of the elites. And of course, I guess she is. And I think those people who voted for Trump felt like they don't care about us. And then the Comey thing 11 days before reopened that again, and that combined with the Russia interference.
What's your understanding of the Russia and the Trump administration broadly defined? Because what it seems to me is that it may not be that the Trump administration or Trump officials overtly colluded in a kind of spy movie, apocalyptic sort of way, but they opened themselves up, Trump in particular, in his business dealings over the years, to compromise in a way that now affects policy.
You know, we will see. Mueller, I have faith that Mueller will get to the bottom of this. I think he's tough, smart. I think he's hired great people. He's hired people to look at those financial dealings. I mean, it's clear that Donald Jr. said in 2008 that a disproportion of the money in their operation was coming from Russia. I mean, there's no question. And the Russians have a way of compromising people, so they got them. So I think we will find out that aspect of it, I think, through Mueller. And that's why I think it becomes a constitutional crisis if Trump fires him, and Trump will, if he fires him, it will be without cause, and that will create a crisis. That's why I'm a little disappointed that we aren't focused. It doesn't seem to be, we seem to be focused on what was the Trump campaigns. Did they interfere?
Well, did you not feel lied to by Jeff Sessions?
Yeah, I did. And again, he didn't answer my question. He answered a different question. I asked him basically, would he recuse himself? It turned out that these reports that members of the Trump campaign had communicated with the Russians and kept communicating with them. And he answered the question by saying, I didn't do that. I didn't meet with any Russians, didn't communicate with any Russians during the campaign. And then not for till 7 weeks later did the Washington Post come out with it. And at that point, he recused himself, of course. So that's why this Trump saying, well, he should have told me he was going to recuse himself before I would have nominated him. He didn't know he was going to recuse himself until he was outed as meeting with Kislyak and the ambassador. And so I think we will find out that aspect of it, I think, through Mueller.
Clearly, Donald Trump on some level has talent, performative talent at the microphone. He appeals to people in a way that reaches their gut and their funny bone, even whether you like it or not. And as somebody who spent so much time in comedy and in front of the camera and writing for Saturday Night Live, does he remind you of anybody? I mean, is he an Andrew Dice Clay figure? Who how would you assess his comedic talent or his?
I don't personally think that he's. I kind of thought he had a sense of humor at one point early on, and I, you know, during the campaign, I actually talked to Huma and Hillary at one stop. And they said when he's on, they watch him because it makes them laugh. But I'm not sure that was a kind of laugh that he was going for. I guess he makes his audience laugh. But I've noticed something, which is, and I still haven't seen it happen, I've never seen him laugh.
Certainly not at himself.
Well, just never seen him laugh.
Period.
Yeah, he's like some fairy tale, you know, where if someone can get the king to laugh, they'll get half the fortune and the daughter or something. I mean, it is. I've not seen him laugh.
Last question relates to your book.
See, I laugh all the damn time, even if it's just
laugh. This relates to my last question. Years ago, I called your office and said, I want to do a profile for The New Yorker of Al Franken. And they said, look, there's nothing we'd like more, but we really don't want to do it because we know where the questions will go. You start asking about Saturday Night Live and the Grateful Dead and drug use and all that stuff. And we're trying, and the word you use in here is dehumorize Al Franken. We have to, in our first phase,
calm it down.
Now you're kind of unleashed, and this book is hilarious, and you joke around. You've been reelected.
Hilarious. The New Yorker.
But it tells
me. Can we? Do we get to
but
do
it
that?
Tells me that maybe you are also, well, more at ease at all this.
Of course. I mean, that's part of what the book talks about. As I said, I barely won.
You won by 300 votes. I think it's the narrowest.
312.
Okay.
Please. Well, please.
But maybe the narrowest election in the history.
On a percentage basis.
All right.
Okay. And that was in a great year. That was one of the best years Democrats had in, you know, I don't know how long.
But your opponent used your comedy against you all the time.
And that was the dehumorizer in the book is this $15 million machine to take out any context or irony or hyperbole or anything to make anything I had said in 38 years of comedy or written horrible. And so Once I got to the Senate, I built my own dehumorizer, which was my staff. So they told me I couldn't. They stopped me.
But now you're Al Franken Unbound.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, no, it's not Unbound. I mean, I still have the dehumorizer.
Excellent.
It still operates
in
our office.
You keep it in the closet.
But it's right out there. The whole staff is deputized to operate the dehumorizer anytime with me. Keep that in the car. Okay, that's for the car. I hear that a lot. It's just a different ballgame. When I first got there, I had to prove to Minnesotans that I was serious.
But now that you're unleashed, does this mean there's just no chance that you'll ever run for president?
Well, I don't think those are connected. I don't think those are connected. I just think that, I think the president of the United States should be somebody who really wants to be president.
You don't want to.
I've seen the presidency up closer as a senator than I did as a comedian. And it looks very hard. It looks very difficult and like a lot of pressure.
Al Franken of Minnesota, a giant of the Senate. His new book is called Giant of the Senate. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
All right, good. How you doing?
All right.
Good to see you.
Everybody okay at home?
More, I hope so. Yeah. They were when I left.
Emily Flake has been drawing cartoons for The New Yorker since 2008. She's sharp, she's versatile, she's very funny. And she does politics, pop culture, and parenting equally well. One cartoon has a worried-looking couple reading a letter. And the man says, "Our health insurance is being replaced by a series of tweets calling us losers." In a moment when a lot of us are feeling pretty anxious about the state of the country, I asked her how she takes her mind off it to get work done.
I mean, the things that I've been using to make myself feel happier, besides giant bags of candy.
Mm-hmm. Which candy do you like?
Mary Jane's, Bit of Honey's. I like the caramelly,
you like the really
sticky things.
You don't have a filling left in your mouth, do you?
No. I gum them. It's very, it's really undignified.
But these are not your suggestions.
These are not my suggestions.
What are?
So I bought a book on the internet. This is called The Importance of Living by Lin Yu Tang. He is a Chinese fella. He wrote this in 1937, and it's sort of like a rambling philosophical book about life and how to live it, more or less. It's written in the 30s, so it's not sexist, but...
Where did he live? Who was he?
He lived in New York. Want me to Wikipedia this real quick? Because I'll totally do that.
I think a radio audience would love that.
Yeah. Hold on, radio audience, while I play around on my phone. I don't know. You guys Google it. He wrote this book that is really, and it's like scarily prescient.
You want to give us an example?
Sure.
It's Lin Yu Tang's book, and it's called?
The Importance of Living. This isn't going to cheer anybody up.
This is from a chapter called Having a Mind.
Yeah. So knowing then our human frailties, we have the more reason to hate the despicable wretch who in demagogue fashion makes use of our human foibles to hound us into another world war, who inculcates hatred of which we already have too much, who glorifies self-aggrandizement and self-interest of which there is no lack, who appeals to our animal bigotry and racial prejudice, who deletes the fifth commandment in the training of youth and encourages killing and war as noble, as if we were not already warlike enough creatures, and who whips up and stirs our mortal passions as if we were not already very near the beast.
You were going to make us feel better about current affairs.
Would you like some candy? Yeah.
So, Emily, do you have another incredibly uplifting suggestion?
I do. When I'm not looking at history to tell me how terrible things are going to be, I crawl down eBay wormholes looking for other historical things I like. I fell in love with this magazine. because of a book that I bought at a used bookstore that was like a compendium of their food writing.
Holiday Magazine.
Yeah.
Which was Roger Angel's first job.
Yeah, he's got a piece in this.
What's it about?
It's about shopping in New York.
Wow, we can torture him with that.
Let's do, can
yeah,
we? That would be amazing.
Can. We absolutely can.
But it's this incredible, it's
huge.
This
is April 1949, mm-hmm. a piece about shopping written by Roger Angel, who's still very much on the staff and writes for us about baseball and other things. Amazing. It's a beautiful magazine, too. It looks the way magazines no longer can, let's just put it this way, afford to. It's about twice the size of an ordinary magazine.
Yeah. And just gorgeous illustration. And the writing strikes this tone sort of between like chummy and erudite that is really charming and readable. It's fantastic.
And so as a cartoonist, do you, other than the books that you've got and things that you can find on the internet, are there magazines that you go look at? And other than Old New Yorkers, who else did cartooning that you can benefit by?
Playboy. Yeah. just read it for the cartoons.
Yeah.
There's one, and I don't remember if this was in Playboy or it might have been in Penthouse. It's some skin mag. And it's two little boys holding a syringe over their sleeping parents. And they're like, won't mom and dad be angry to wake up and find out they're heroin addicts? Yeah, I'm like, this is my favorite cartoon. In the whole world.
That didn't make it into The New Yorker.
Somehow somebody slept on that.
Maybe this week.
Yeah.
And so your daughter is 4?
She is.
What kind of magazines? What do you want her to be reading when the time comes?
National Lampoon, if I can get some of those on eBay. Old Playboys when the nudes were still tasteful. I don't know. I hope my daughter, when magazine time comes, like is able to read magazines and doesn't have to spend all of her time fighting sentient robots.
Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cartoonist Emily Flake. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for today. You can stick with the show all week by following us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Toon Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrada. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Jessica Henderson, Rob Byers, Carol Chichotsky, Eric Malinsky, and Nick Palmgarten. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.